Let me tell you my story as an introduction to what I'm going to tell you, and so that you will understand why this talk is going to be historical. So I will claim this is going to be the less sophisticated talk in the history of this institution. Okay?
You have a lot of competition there.
Well, you will see, I will. Okay, so I got a student that wanted to do something Magian. That was his. He came to me and saying, I want to do something Magian.
Magian.
Okay, well, I can try to advise you. And he went, read the literature, and came back to me and said, I want to work with this thing, which is called the Weber force. Cool. Let's just try to. Okay, so we were starting, and suddenly, as if the gods of science wanted me to do this, Tim joined our group. And he gave a talk and was telling, well, you know, we do this, we only do this with n-body. We can only do it in the n-body Newtonian limit or with full GR, but we have no examples that are more or less in the middle. And I said, well, this Magian stuff fits exactly there. And what we did was to try to implement the methods that Tim was developing, in which you take a theory and you map it into a fully relational language for this Magian theory. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. Okay. So, by the way, I was thinking that a good criteria to know that I am actually an outsider from the shape dynamic people is that I have no pictures made by Flavio. All my pictures are stolen from the internet. So, okay, so. So this is an outsider point of view.
Didn't you get the email? The Flavio sphere is mandatory to all.
Anyway, so the interesting feature of this interaction I'm going to study is that it has an extra dimensionful coupling constant to it. Besides having the Newton constant, it has what it would be the speed of light. It's weird to call it that way. So the question is whether we can perform an algorithm to get a fully relational picture of this interaction, and how many dimensions will the shape space have? Because, for example, in Tim's talk, he claimed that because he had a cosmological constant, having a cosmological constant adds a dimension to the shape space. That was one of his sentences. So will this happen here or not? Can we learn something more or less generic? Well, so. That's why this silly example I'm going to present is kind of interesting. So let me tell you a little bit about Weber's electrodynamics first. I'm going to actually work with Weber's gravity. And the way to pass from one to the other is as taking Coulomb and switching into Newton's theory. So, OK. So Weber was a very clever mid-19th century guy. This is the same Weber for which some units in magnetism are named on. And he developed a theory of electromagnetism that was incredibly successful in that it unified many different, at the time were different experiments. So this is called Weber electrodynamics, and it's a theory of charged particle forces that interact directly through forces. There are no fields. And as I was saying, it describes the Coulomb force, the Ampere, and the Faraday experiments. And in a way, it has electromagnetic radiation. And it is actually the first hint that light has something to do with electromagnetism, because these additional coupling constants turns out to be, or to coincide with the velocity of light. So. Yeah, so what I mean is that if you have an accelerated particle, charged particle, and there are other charged particles in the universe, your particle will lose energy, OK? Yeah. And by the way, Julian is the expert on history of science. I know very little, but apparently Maxwell himself thought this was the correct scheme for electromagnetism for a time, but then there was some people making noise and saying that this scheme does not conserve energy. So Maxwell thought, no, this cannot be good. He turned into fields. And at the end, it turns out that this does conserve energy. Anyway, so this is one of the funny things in the history of science. So Maxwell would have pushed this thing if the proof of the conservation of the energy would have been available.
That was just at the time energy conservation became established.
You know?
His paper was 1847.
Okay. Well, and we do know this is not the correct theory. This is not that this is a competitive theory. So I'm going to take it that way, as a toy model that has some nice features. So let me present you the force, the concrete expression, in the context of the gravitational version. So this is a force that particle 1 feels due to particle 2. And if you only see this piece, it's exactly Newton's force. And then it gets corrections, which go like the relative velocity of particle 1 and 2. This is very important. This is, well, and then this concerns the relative acceleration. Okay, so in this language, this is the relative distance, and we are all familiar with the fact that Newton's gravity depends on the relative distance and only that. But notice that r12 dot is the time derivative of r12, and it's not the norm of the full velocity, right? It's just the relative velocity. And the same definition is used for the acceleration. So it's a completely relational theory in this sense, right? However, it is conceived on top of a Newtonian space-time. So time at this stage is external. And as I already said, it has another dimensional object, which is c, which is coincides with the speed of light.
Yuri, you have to have another constant to match up the dimensions with the gravitational one. So this has to be another dimensional constant.
Yeah.
And why is it called the speed of light? Because of the, what's the explanation for saying it's the speed of light?
Because, so you put there a constant, you notice it has to be a velocity constant because of dimensional arrays.
Yes.
And then you do a best fit with experiments.
Ah, right.
And then you compare the numbers and whoa, it is extremely close to the measured speed of light.
Okay,
so that's why the name arose. And then it is, this morning we heard the word, this potential is homogeneous and blah, 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 several times repeatedly. So it is very interesting that at first sight this is non-homogeneous, right? So many of the developed results from these people here do not apply or do not seem to apply. So that's another nice feature to study this. However, as it is fully relational in the sense I described, it is invariant under global rotations and translations, right? It only depends on relative velocity, relative distances. So I can translate my origin and nothing will happen to the theory. So okay, the standard counting of independent degrees of freedom holds. Another nice feature is that, the third law of Newton holds, it's quite evident. It is a central force, right? This is the direction. And as I will show, it is conservative. So a system of m particles interacting through this force conserves total momentum, total angular momentum, and total energy. And as its electromagnetic counterpart, it does incorporate some, modern gravitational phenomena. So this number is actually tuned to give the correct perihelion precession for Mercury, I think. It has radiation in the same sense I described for electromagnetism. It is compatible, that's trivial, with the universality of free fall. of course, we can get the Newtonian limit by simply turning off these two terms. And again,
I ask again, the perihelion precession comes out right if you have the speed of light perceived.
Yeah, if you put a 3 and a 6 here.
Yeah. Oh, you're putting a 3 and a 6. So
yeah. But remarkably, you know, I have two terms. In principle, I would have two different coupling constants.
There is a potential which would fix the 3 and the 6. I mean, if you just have the label potential, that doesn't have a two constants, does it?
No, it only has one. So that's a nice feature of it.
Yeah.
If the constants were not 6 and 3 divided by C squared, this wouldn't come from a potential. So it's remarkable that the thing that comes from the potential also describes this
so
well-known. It wouldn't be. Yeah.
It wouldn't be.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, again, this is falsifiable. One example is that light is not affected by gravity in this scheme. So for me, it's just a toy model to learn something about the algorithm used in shape dynamics. Can you speak louder, please?
Sorry, are they related to any PPM parameter?
Good question. I don't know.
When you say light isn't affected, you mean it's not clear to me what you mean here, in the Newtonian context.
Well, what I mean is that the matless particles feel no forces and generate no forces, and hence light would travel in straight paths in Newtonian spacetime. And we know that's not the case. So this is just an example of how can you falsify this. So I don't want anybody to think I'm supporting this theory. And okay.
So okay. One other thing, you know,
sure.
I think it gives anisotropic effective masses. The Weber potential gives anisotropic effective masses.
I don't see how. I mean, anisotropic, yes, because perhaps we're here and the only other big mass in the universe is over there.
Well, I mean,
so we would feel something weird happening.
Just have the Weber potential, just the Weber potential, not the potential. The solar system reflects the presence of the galaxy.
Say again?
The solar system, you can see in the solar system the effect of the galaxy.
Yeah, I believe that.
Sorry, I'm a little slow.
Okay.
You said it was conserved. Or it wasn't conserved, but then on the slide I see it is conserved. How are your statements compatible? The fact that there is radiation and
okay, because these are the total energy, for example. So I may have a system here orbiting each other and it's losing energy, but it's only losing it because a third particle over there is absorbing it. Okay? So in that sense there's radiation.
And
what we don't have, sorry, is an infinity that its energy, its radiation energy. So in that sense, this is Machian. This is a Machian theory, so which is very beautiful, I would say. Okay.
So this is, you said it does not affect light, but if you take a limit with the inertial, with Newton's inertial law, and you take a limit to mass versus zero, do you get wrong deflection for light as you do with the Newtonian limit?
Well, I think those analyses are kind of tricky. So what I'm saying is that massless particles feel no force and exert no force. I know you can play and get ratios and take limits at the end, and even claim Newtonian black holes exist, but I don't support those point of views. Okay. So let me tell you. So my challenge given by my interaction with Tim, through my interaction with Tim, was to come out with an algorithm to try to find the fully relational expressions for this, try to see what the shape space dimension is and all that. And I tried several ways of doing that, and I found that this is the most efficient way to do that. So I think this could be also useful for you. So I'm going to tell you what the algorithm that extremizes, minimizes the effort according to my experiences. So the first step is to start with the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian picture of this. I will have to tell you how to get the Lagrangian version of this force. So I'm going actually to work in the Lagrangian formalism, but people here like the Hamiltonian, and all this carries out. And then actually I'm going to write a Hamiltonian-like equations of motion, and I will have to read a configuration space metric. This is key to the algorithm, as you will see. Then I need to find a fundamental length scale and an intrinsic parametrization for the system. I switch the equations of motions into this parameter. I normalize everything. I have to get only dimensionless coordinates or quantities. And then I need, typically the system won't close here. I won't be able to only describe the evolution by saying how these normalized things evolve. So I will need to choose an extra dimensionless variable and then check if this system of equation including this variable closes. And if not, I need to choose another one, check if closes. So in this sense, this is an algorithm. And perhaps it closes, perhaps it doesn't, right? Perhaps so. Let's check what happens for the Weber force. OK, so it turns out that Weber force can be derived from this Lagrangian, which is the conventional kinetic term, plus a potential, which is the conventional Newtonian term, and the correction. So here you see that there is only one dimensionful constant, which is c squared over 3. However, this is not a convenient setting. It is much easier to switch this unconventional part out of the potential and move it into the kinetic part, okay? Because this is a weird potential, right? It depends on relative distances, but also in velocities, relative velocities. Okay, who wants to call that a potential? So it turns out that this is doable. And in the potential side, I get only the Newtonian potential. And the price to pay is that the kinetic energy term is nasty. But it still has some features, chiefly that I can describe it as by a metric, right? So R is the standard notation. I'm using even a vector. This is for the ith particle, and here, X is the XYZ for the eye, okay? So, and this is the metric. So if I'm only considering one particle, the ith particle, this is the metric that relates X, Y, and Z. And if I consider different particles, okay. So again, let me just make a statement. Again, it is, now the potential is homogeneous, but the metric is not, right? Because here I have something that is independent on everything. It only depends on the masses of the particle. And here I do have things that may change when I rescale distances. So,
doesn't that perhaps clarify what Julian was asking? Perhaps it's not it's really the inertial mass that is effective inertial mass that is anisotropic because of that kinetic metric. But if you compare it to the gravitational mass,
I come from the Lorentz violating community. And for us, anisotropy means a fundamental anisotropy that there's no source for it. So in that sense, for me, this is never anisotropic, because every time I do an experiment and I feel a special direction is pointing me through there, it's because there's a mass over there, right? So in this sense, I cannot call it anisotropic. But this is what it is. Call it as you wish. But
I suspect it will be killed by the Hughes-Greber experiment.
There's
an effective anisotropy.
But because we have the moon or something, not because there's something attached to.
Actually, if I intervene, the potential without the Newton part, take the Newton part away,
okay.
Just leave the Weber part. That was introduced in 1915 by Reissner and considered again by Schrödinger in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
And both Reissner and Schrödinger knew that it would lead to anisotropic inertial mass effective.
Okay.
And Schrödinger showed that the when he looked at the data that he knew about the data of the galaxy, that it would produce perturbations of the planetary orbits that were not, were on the verge of being disprovable, and now they're way disprovable. But it's a fascinating potential for all that. But I mean, a lot of people, it is very interesting potential.
So it's anisotropic in the sense that it doesn't have the special property of Newton's theory.
Right.
It doesn't depend acceleration measurements of the mass would not depend on the presence of the galaxy or large masses nearby.
Okay. And of course, if you switch that effect into the metric, now you have a metric.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so this is the setting I'm going to work with. And from now on, I'm going to forget about the details of the metric G because it's actually quite hard to carry them. So, and I'm going to consider that all particles have the same mass. To be honest, this is a silly assumption because I could forget about this assumption and nothing essentially changes. This is what I tried to say there. But I'm going to write then my Lagrangian as this kinetic term. Now I'm switching to A and B as configuration space indices, so they collect the particle and the x, y, z index, and un is the Newtonian potential. So notice that I am extracting from the metric the mass so that it is dimensionless. And this is to so that everybody can follow the dimensionality easily. So if you see an F, which looks like a force, it will have dimensions of force. If you see a mem, okay, so everything has the dimension you think it has, okay? So okay, formally to get the Hamiltonian out of this is trivial because the conjugate momentum are G inverse times X dot. And so this is the Hamiltonian. I use the word formally because actually inverting the metric is quite hard, right? But okay. And then the energy, which is defined as the Hamiltonian in the trajectory you are, which is kinetic plus potential energy, is conserved. Okay, this is then the proof. Okay. So this was the first step in my algorithm to get the Lagrangian. Now let's get to the second, which is to write the equations of motion as first order equations. So as expected, the equations of motion arising directly from the Lagrangian can be written in this very familiar way. So essentially, the geodesic, this would be a geodesic, but it's not because there's a force acting on it, where the Christoffel symbols are exactly this, and the force is what you expect. Just notice that these indices run through the entire configuration space and not space-time, okay? And then if I define B as X dot, I can rewrite this trivially like this. Okay, so second step of the algorithm, check. Third step, gone. What happened? I kind of press everything at the same time and
there's a mute button.
Ah, apparently.
This one.
Okay.
Or maybe the other one.
Okay. So now I need to construct something that has length units and something that I can use as a as an intrinsic parametrization of the curve. Thanks. And given that I have a metric, it's actually very easy to construct the first thing. So I can define something that measures length through this formula. And after doing so, I can switch from T into this dimensionless parameter with this formula. Well, so then what you can see allows me to, well, this is going to appear everywhere. This is what allows me to switch from T into S, and it contains the, I don't know how to call it, but the magnitude of the velocity. This is conformal configuration space velocity. Okay, but the point is that I can switch easily into this new parameter. So these are still dimensionful because I have velocity divided by something dimensionless. And here I have, okay? So the next step in the algorithm is to get rid of the dimensions of x and b. And that I can do by simply dividing b by this and q by n x by r, right? So simply I switch variables, I keep track of what my equations are, and I'm only done. So by the way, Tim made the comment that his equation for the change of Q was purely kinematical. And at this stage, I have the purely kinematical part plus something else. So one question that is popping out is, would this equation be purely kinematical, or I have a mixture of kinematics and dynamics? And of course, this is not purely relational, because I have tons of stuff in my right-hand side that are, external, so to speak. So I need to keep pushing this. And to do that, it's clear that I do need an extra dimensionless quantity. And I need to build it with the objects I have, which are essentially listed here. Right? So I would need, for example, to build things that have energy units and take the ratio. That would work. So what can I use? Well, it is not convenient to use R and B at the same time, because those are the objects I need to get rid of here. So it is convenient to only use one. I will take R. It is also not convenient to use E, because at a given stage, I want to sit in the E equals 0 case. So better not use it then. So what I decide to do is to use the ratio of the gravitational Newtonian energy and the rest energy. And notice the rest energy being mc squared. So the rest energy is something I don't have in the purely Newtonian case. So I will actually claim that having c is not a burden. It is quite convenient. OK, so I will choose kappa to be my dimensionless quantity. It only depends. I mean, the only thing that is dynamical here is capital R. And I know how it changes. So I can compute this for 2 minutes. And well, then I will have to add this equation with this thing plugging on here to the dynamical equations. But I still have VF, Christoffel's, many things that I don't want. I want a purely relational object sitting on my right hand side. So I need to keep working a little bit. So what I will use is that the metric, I extracted an M. So the metric is a Kronecker delta plus a perturbation. And I can prove that it takes this form. Okay. It has a kappa, and the rest is a function only of the q's. And given that the metric takes this form, R times the Christoffel symbols becomes kappa times some functions only on the q, which are extremely long to be written here, but which we have explicitly. This product is dimensionless. So n kappa is dimensionless, so gamma is dimensionless. Now, I will define B to be by this equation. So I take the Newtonian potential, and I extract everything that has dimensions out of it. And I get B, which is a function of the q's. I can also write it this way. And then it is also quite simple to see that R times F, F being the force, gets this form. So this has dimensions of energy. Kappa is dimensionless, mc squared has dimensions of energy, and that's dimensionless. And then perhaps the longest trick is to use the fact that the kinetic energy is actually mb squared over 2. And from there, I can link energy this b with the b. So I have managed to write everything in terms of capital B, little f, and gamma, which are dimensionless functions of only the internal degrees of freedom, the q's. So after plugging back, I get this very nice system of equations. It closes. OK, I have nothing else, right? Like the right-hand side only depends on u, q, and kappa. So in that sense, we say it closes. I can recover the Newtonian case trivially by setting the metric to be only the delta. So this becomes a delta, and gamma vanishes. I have a lot of control on the Newtonian case by doing this. So it closes, it needs no additional variable. And if we do the counting, it has the exact same number of degrees of freedom than the Newtonian case. So having an extra dimensionful quantity in this case change essentially nothing, right? The shape space dimension is the same. There's nothing to scary about. So this is the counting, right? I have Q's and P's, which I counted their degrees of freedom at the beginning, plus one extra thing, which is the kappa, which has to do with the global scale. But then I have two constraints to subtract from this, coming from the fact that Q and U have unit one, right? So in particular, you can see that E equals zero is not particularly a special case, because sometimes I hear this guy saying, well, when I add the constraint that E equals zero, I don't think E equals zero is a constraint, it's just a particular initial data set. And the only thing that changes is that this term is not there, but the counting and the algorithm itself carries on exactly in the same way. Now, note that the first two terms here, what I have is, for example, here. Here I have the force, well, the relational force, if you wish, but it is projected into the orthogonal space to the U's, right? This is the projector. If I multiply this guy by U, it gives me zero. So here in the upper level, I have only the orthogonal part of the force. And the same happens here. Here I have U projected into the normal Q plane. And then these two guys, which look kind of complicated, are sitting there such that the dynamics doesn't change the fact that U and Q were defined to have norm one, okay? So if I have Q and U here and I have them there, well, the norm is obtained with the metric here or the metric there, and the metric is changing. So this change of the metric is here in the gammas, in the reduced Christoffel symbol or whatever you want to call them. So I would claim that this equation is purely kinematical. This is telling me that the change of Q is orthogonal to U and that I have to respect the fact that it has norm one. Okay, so I think I'm done. I kept my promise. This was a shallow talk, no technicalities. But the conclusions from this could be interesting for the people in the shape community. And they are that, we found an algorithm to take this theory that was pre-relational in the sense that it only depended on relative distance, velocity, and acceleration, and bring it into a fully relational language in which there is no external time and everything is dimensionless. The effects of C, we were able to incorporate this theory that had a C without changing essentially anything. In fact, having the C was quite useful. It allows us to define the kappa that I actually used, which shortens the algorithm a little bit. And what I want to study now is whether I can apply the same algorithm to more complicated theories, in a sense, right? A theory, for example, a relational mond. What I mean by that is that a force, a Newtonian force, for example, that is modified by a term that is sensitive to only relative accelerations. Because I don't know if everybody knows mond, but mond is a theory that incorporates a new acceleration scale. That's simply crazy because acceleration is frame dependent. So here we could write something that incorporates a new relative acceleration scale. So in that sense, I would be less bothered by this. So what I like to say is that somehow these questions that are now settled there, I think there were partly myths within the shape community. I think everybody was, extra dimension full constant will add an extra dimension. And I'm happy that we busted some of these myths and did a concrete example that lies more or less in the middle in between Newtonian and Einsteinian gravity. So thank you. That was fast.
Here you could implement this into a deformed kinematic metric, because you had C and G, right? Together you could form something that has the right dimensions for here in a metric on a convergence field. So can you do the same? Does the same hold for a theory with an acceleration scale? G and A? Can I already say it won't appear as a deformed kinematic metric or not?
I would dare to say that every time you have a theory in which you can, which is pre-relational in this sense, and you can write the Lagrangian as I did, I mean, you can write the kinetic term as I did, and perhaps this, I don't know if the homogeneity of this part is crucial or not, but I would dare to say that the explicit form of this G doesn't matter. That's what that's as far as I would dare to commit myself.
Well,
as far as it is a metric, and symmetric, and be named G, because otherwise,
How much do you know about the structure of the solution? Like, for example, are there also attractors on the shape space in this way of thinking of it, or one way to understand the effect of scale in the other model that we projected is as dissipation on shape space. Can you tell if anything on that?
No, I cannot. I haven't gotten farther than this. But I can tell you what my hunch is on what could be interesting. So I think in the Newtonian system, you can define clocks by taking binary systems, right? So the system is complicated, but it will evolve into something that has many binary pairs that are more or less far away, and each of them will give you a clock. And I think a statement that I've heard you saying is that these clocks are more or less universal. So what I think is that here, because of these radiation effects, the universality of these kind of clocks would not hold. So I don't know if that would be interesting or not. But then I can ask whether or not there is a narrow of time. And there I think the answer would be positive. Like, even though here I have I don't have the theorem that used homogeneity. And from there, right? That was the key part of the talk this morning, was that homogeneity of the potential gives you this U-shape behavior. And then we don't have that. However, I believe an hour of time would be present. I don't know.
Thank you. May I say just one or two words on the blackboard?
Because, please.
I was involved with quite a lot of thinking about the Weber potential back in 45 years ago. And it's remarkably interesting, I think, that my memory is the following. You just start off to make a Machian theory, and you just say that, and you want to make it reparametrization invariant, so your Lagrange function is integral d lambda square root of r I j dot square over r I j. That's the whole theory. And basically, Reissner in 1915 had that. And Schrödinger had it again in 1925, but he apologized later for saying he half-remembered it from Reissner's paper. But I had a crazy student called Easthope, and he did some calculations. And if I remember rightly, and it'd be interesting, it would be very easy to check on somebody could do it. This guy found that this thing has quasi-bound states. If two particles approach each other, because of the nature of this this is a dot here, they come in and they circle around each other for quite a long time and then they fly apart. That's my recollection from it. And while they're semi-bound, if you have two such things like this, they attract each other gravitationally. So you have complete representation of inertial motion. So you have sort of everything comes out of this that you want, except that the real bugbear is that this thing generates anisotropic inertia. And so you can see the effects of the solar system. There's a paper by Ken Northcutt in 1975 or something, where he shows it explicitly, where you, besides, this generates perihelion advances. You fit the perihelion advance, you get all these intriguing features where you unify. There's no equivalence principle. God, sorry, I should have put MI and MJ, the masses.
And
this is just one mass. There's no gravitational mass or inertial mass. It all comes out together, but it's got this hopeless feature of anisotropic inertia. But it's a very intriguing thing.
Is this the same theory? Or is this the same theory?
Well, no, Urey, I think, is still putting in a Newtonian kinetic term, are you not, to some extent, or not really?
Yeah.
Are you putting the Newton potential, at least you're doing gravity plus this.
Yeah.
But this seems to give, to some extent, gravity. It's
but
not perfect gravity.
Aren't
but
you missing this?
Like a gravitational attraction.
Don't you need a C, the speed of light?
Well, you won't need it because, well, it'll have some dimension, but you'd have some constant to make it dimensionless. But that would just be a purely normalization.
Okay.
But I have a feeling that there is something, when you actually look at it, there is a distinguished velocity comes out as well. Oh. It would be worth looking at again. If you've got some student who wants to do another Machian thing,
okay,
get them to see whether there really are bound states, like, or quasi-bound states. If the impact parameter is small enough, they last longer and longer and longer. Mm. And then two of these things will interact each will attract each other a la Newtonian gravity.
Mm.
And Reisner realized this. And then it was rediscovered 60 years later by me, and curiously by one other person as well at the same time.
Shouldn't there be a spiral in a Weber semi-dynamics when they would radiate energy to other? So if you have a bound pair, faraway masses, they lose energy with the interaction with these masses, but you still have the gravitational potential. So wouldn't they spiral?
You're curious. No, I think what it is, they get into circular orbits, and then of course the velocity, the rate of change of the distances drops out, so they're just bound by the Newton potential. It's
Lagrangian, but with
the. Oh, I don't know about yours, why not?
No.
Yeah. Anyway, it would be worth exploring just as an exercise for a student sometime, and you could do some nice numerical calculations to see what happens.
And then we can challenge your figures.
You should study this thing, but in case we can draw the figures then.
Okay. But there are no more questions. You can go to the break.
Okay.